Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between our personal health and well-being and the health of our water, food, earth, and air, the health of our communities, the health of our society, the health of our global planet Earth and all its peoples. And each week on the show, we talk to different thought leaders, experts, advocates, scientists, lawyers, authors, filmmakers about the different facets of our interconnected world that impact us. Today's guest is a return guest to this show. I'm thrilled to have her here. She is Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. And I have to say that in the battles and the coverage that we did several years back on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the other trade agreements, which ultimately did not end up coming to a final approval vote in Congress in 2016, as anticipated, is due to the work of a whole host of advocacy organizations, and the lead organization and lead person in that organization is our guest today, Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Lori is a 25-year veteran of congressional trade battles, over beginning with NAFTA and kind of going on from there. She has testified on a range of issues before covering trade and globalization before 30 congressional committees and has appeared as a trade commentator on MSNBC, Fox, CNN, and a host of other outlets. She's also written two books on trade, The Rise and Fall of Fast-Track Trade Authority, and Who's Trade Organization, A Comprehensive Guide to the WTO. And she's a founder of the Citizens Trade Campaign, a U.S. national coalition of consumer, labor, environmental, family, farm, religious, and civil rights groups representing over 11 million Americans. And, of course, regular listeners to this show will know what a big role trade policy played in the 2016 election. And currently on the table, and we've done several shows about it, is a revision of the NAFTA agreement. And Lori's here with us today to discuss the up and down sides and kind of take us inside the ongoing process of renegotiating NAFTA, the North Atlantic Free Trade Alliance. Welcome back to Connect the Dots, Lori Wallach.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the kind introduction.
So, you know, we've had other guests on the show discussing this, and, you know, one of the things that has been among the sort of top most heinous things in this trade deal, and these trade deals, is the ISDS process by which corporations can actually sue governments for noncompliance and, you know, and the loss of their future earnings and bring them before a private court with no due process, with the citizens of a country or a locality stuck kind of paying the bill for the loss of corporate profits if, for example, they wish to protect their land, their food supply, the health of citizens, and all the rest of it. And so the ISDS provisions have been among the most heinous and, you know, kind of singularly really representing a global shift of a kind that we, you know, ordinary people don't need or want. So, you know, I was surprised to read in a recent article that you wrote for The Prospect, that the American Prospect, that actually the ISDS provisions are, and this is Investor State Dispute Settlement, is on its way out. Can you update our listeners about what's going on with that now? Because that's kind of a good news surprise.
Yeah, it's great news, actually. And, you know, the backstory is Investor State Dispute Settlement was exactly what you said, one of the motivating reasons for consumer groups like mine, for the environmental movement, for progressives in Congress to battle full-throatedly against TPP. And ISDS started being in trade agreements with NAFTA. Under ISDS, multinational corporations can sue governments before a panel of three corporate lawyers the lawyers can award the corporations unlimited sums to be paid by us taxpayers, including for loss of their expected future profits, over claims that our domestic laws, court decisions, environmental regulations violate their NAFTA rights, or if TPP had gone into effect, their TPP rights. And decisions aren't subject to outside appeal. So you have three corporate lawyers rotating between being the judge and being the lawyer who sues a government for a corporation. It's an outrageous system. And under NAFTA, already almost $400 million has been paid out by North American taxpayers to corporations after successful ISDS attacks on environmental and health policies, toxic bans, timber policies, water policies. It's been really bad. So the top demand, everyone in the progressive world, unions, consumer groups, environmental groups, the Democrats who are progressive in Congress, the top demand from everyone was for NAFTA renegotiation was ISDS has to come out. ISDS has been in NAFTA causing this damage, causing $380 million worth of payouts to corporations for 25 years now. It had to go. And the shocker is we're going to win that. It's going. Now, it's still something the corporate lobby is apoplectic about, because what ended up happening is and everyone's going to say, wait, these special corporate powers we've been fighting for 20 years are going to be taken out of NAFTA by this administration? What? I'm going to explain why. That's a natural question. If you're not thinking it, you're not paying attention. So I will, for your listeners, I will explain how that could possibly be. But the reality is that language is coming out, and the corporate lobby is beside itself. So anyone who wants to really get upset, go to the American Petroleum Institute's website, and you can watch the ads that they have spent $1 million-plus playing on MSNBC and Fox Cable since last week in defense of Save ISDS in NAFTA. To me, it's the best sign that we're winning that one, that they're actually putting up that last-ditch effort. But the ISDS has gotten so unpopular around the world as more and more laws are being attacked successfully that a lot of countries are just leaving it altogether. I mean, India has, and South Africa has, Indonesia has, Bolivia, Ecuador, they've all exited the system. So it's super, super important that the U.S. is setting the signal, because a lot of other countries that aren't as big as in Indonesia or in India, they want out. And when they can now say, look, Brazil's never gotten in, all these other developing countries are out, look at even the U.S. that it's bad. It gives a lot of policy space for other countries who want to exit this corporate regime to also have the political space to do it. So that's really good news. And there's some other things that progressives have always wanted that have become official U.S. government demands in the talks. Like another thing that is going to be in the deal, or there's not going to be a deal, everyone's being told this by the negotiators, is a sunset clause. So that every 5 years, NAFTA would have to be reviewed and explicitly reauthorized where it ends. So no more of this 23 years of endless damage. Like the federal government has certified over 930,000 jobs is lost explicitly to NAFTA. And it's gone on for 23 years of hemorrhaging jobs, pushing down wages. Wages in Mexico are now 9% lower than before NAFTA. And so we can't have that. This is basically an accountability insertion. There's automatic accountability every 5 years. It either measures up, or it's going to have to get changed, or it's not going to get extended. At least you have a fight every 5 years about how's it worked, what do we want, do we want it to continue? That's a really big deal. Another thing that is in the good news side of the ledger is a proposal to increase what are called the rules of origin. That has to do with how much content of North America has to be in a product to get the NAFTA benefits. And the deal there is if you get the right environmental and labor standards, you only want the benefits of the agreement to pertain to the products that meet those better standards. So right now under NAFTA, a third of the value of a product, the parts, part of the assembly, can happen in a non-NAFTA country and mainly China. And still it counts as a NAFTA product and gets all the benefits. So the U.S. proposal is 75% North American content, but here's the real star. If anyone has a hot cup of coffee, I put it down now because otherwise you're going to drop it. The real stunner is that they're proposing a wage level as well, which is 75% North American. 45% of that has to be produced by workers in North America who make at least $16 an hour. That creates a really helpful draw up on wages in Mexico, but also make sure that U.S. and Canadian workers will basically have that standard as a protection. So that's the good news. I'm going to let you ask some more questions. There's some stuff you're very worried about as well, which I also want to talk about. And we should also talk about how the hell this could possibly be happening under this heinous president.
Well, that's my question. I mean, is this a case of, the Trump administration being true to his word during the campaign, where he was complaining about the fact that this was bad for American workers and companies, and you know, he was going to restore that? I mean, how has this happened that we ironically had a Democratic administration with President Obama pushing for the TPP, saying this was going to be his legacy, and now we have this administration, which has been so reckless toward the American middle class and blue collar workers and the companies that sustain them, now kind of coming in as heroes or something to bring jobs back and manufacturing back to the United States. I mean, that is so amazing. Is it what's going on? How did this come about?
So what's going on is, for whatever reason, one of the only things Trump has been consistent on since I first started in 1991 working on the NAFTA fight, has been his opposition to this model of trade agreements and trade policy. And I can't speculate as to where that feeling comes from originally, but he's been consistent. He did certainly campaign on it extensively. But I think there are two reasons why what he had to say about replacing our failed trade policy has translated into the implementation of a bunch of the longstanding demands by progressives. So here's reason number one. Effectively, if you want to fix the problems caused by these agreements, there are only so many things you can do. Whether you are a Democratic president, a Republican president, or a president from Mars, when you are the president of the United States and you need to fix NAFTA, there are only certain things that can actually change the incentives to outsource jobs, change the related downward pressure on wages. And given Trump effectively has appropriated politically the trade reform agenda from Democrats, from unions, from progressives, it's not that shocking that if he really actually wants to make any of these changes, or even if he feels he's going to be held accountable to delivering on the things that he's demanded, it may slay him. But if he wants to do it, there's really no other way to do it than the way that the Democrats and the unions have been demanding for the last 20 years, which is you're going to have to get rid of the outsourcing incentives at the heart of NAFTA, including the ISDS, which functions as free risk insurance for outsourcing. You're going to have to get rid of the ban on buy local and buy American, so our tax dollars get reinvested to create job here. You're going to have to put real environmental and labor standards and reinforcement of them to increase wages and stop the draw of very low wages in Mexico for outsourcing jobs in the U.S. They're really only things that there are only a short list of things you can do to make the difference. So he is way out in a limb, basically having appropriated the progressive trade agenda to deliver on the changes. And so he's stuck having to take these progressive tools, because that's all that's going to make the difference, even though, yes, you're right, in many ways it contradicts what the rest of the administration is doing. But that gets to point two. Personnel really matters. And when it comes to trade, Trump picked a man named Robert Lighthizer to be the trade representative. This is the guy who, progressive Senator Sherrod Brown on Face the Nation called the best appointee in the Trump administration. So Lighthizer predicted that NAFTA would gut American manufacturing. He's a conservative. He worked as a trade official during the Reagan administration. But he's also got decades of commitment to American manufacturing, and he's worked with unions for years because he was a lawyer in the steel sector. He grew up in Ashtabula, Ohio, and he's seen his whole town gutted. His hometown just, you know, lost hundreds of jobs. And he is a guy who is personally committed to getting this right, and so far, he's been given a wide lane from the president to do it. So here's a guy who has good ties with Republicans, because he is one, good ties with Democrats, because he's worked with them in good faith over decades, has close relationships with the unions from years of working with them and is working directly with them, and the man knows NAFTA inside and out. So he actually knows what has to be changed to make the difference. And that is why those two things, Trump took the agenda from us and the guy he appointed, is kind of a miracle person for the job right now, is why, against all odds, it sure heck ain't a done deal yet. Who knows what will happen? It's not what you expect. It's more likely that the deal they're heading to on NAFTA would be supported by progressives in Congress, by unions, by public citizen, then it will be supported by the Republicans in Congress and the Chamber of Commerce. Now, will they get to a place where we're happy to support an agreement and actually finally replace the ongoing damage of NAFTA that is leading to new investor state attacks and environmental laws every month, that every week more jobs are getting outsourced? Will we be able to finally shut that down with a NAFTA replacement we could support? It's certainly not a done deal, but we have made real progress. And with our partners in the labor movement, with a lot of the most progressive members of Congress, we are working our tails off to try and get that opportunity. How weird would it be in this horrible, hateful, heinous administration if at least one good thing got jit-jit-sued right out from under them, which is the president's put himself out in a limb. If he wants to implement 20 years of Democrats and progressives' demands on trade reform, well, hell, it'd be better to get one good thing out of the next four years of hellish Trump than nothing.
How could this play out in Congress? I mean, is there a coalition of votes that would put this thing through? I mean, and then, of course, I mean, if it's the president's U.S. trade representative, his appointee that has crafted this deal, then it would be extremely odd, although odd things happen under this president, for him to fail to sign it. So it would seem like getting it through the Senate and the Congress, you know, where will things stand if you do, in fact, get this deal crafted and moving forward for approval?
Mm-hmm. So here's a really interesting twist to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
The agreement, as evidence of the fact that it's heading more in a direction, still not there yet, but it's heading more in a direction we would like,
mm-hmm.
The House Republican leadership just last week suddenly declared an arbitrary deadline by which negotiations had to be finished and Congress had to be notified, or they were going to deny Trump a vote on a revised NAFTA for this Congress. Yes, the Republicans in Congress, so beholden to these corporate lobby groups, are going to have decreed an arbitrary deadline to derail a major rewrite of NAFTA and keep the outsourcing incentive in place. They are so committed to basically making sure that they can't have any change to NAFTA that they're trying to make sure a deal can't get done and voted on in this Congress. So that whether or not there is a vote, to some degree, is going to end up being whether or not the Republicans follow through on their bluff, which it may not be a bluff. They may really be that beholden that they are, you know, they've been against these changes to NAFTA since the renegotiation started. So it really could be that they are willing to shut the whole thing down because they just can't tolerate the prospect of changing the rigged trade rules and removing the privileges that their corporate donors use to outsource jobs and attack environmental laws. So if that happens, here's how it plays out politically. Maybe a vote doesn't happen this year. Maybe a vote happens next year when the Democrats are in charge of at least the House, please. And then it'll be even easier to pass the good kind of agreement that we may or may not get. But here is what the math looks like of how this gets passed. Even if it were voted on this year, here's how it gets passed. You have a big block of the Democrats. It's basically the inverse of the TPP vote. You have a big block of the Democrats who've been voting against agreements like NAFTA and TPP forever, who have finally, and again, if, because there's a big if I want to talk about that's not done, that is deciding if, but if they get a deal that has what the Democrats have demanded and the sunset clause and getting rid of ISDS and the stronger rules of origin, that is definitely barking up the right tree. So if they get the rest of the stuff done that needs to get done and Democrats and unions support it, then you have a big block of Democrats in the House and the Senate. You have a smaller block of Republicans, just like there were 56 Republicans who voted no for fast track on TPP. Those are members of Congress either who come from heavy manufacturing districts, or they have a serious concern on sovereignty with investor-state dispute settlement, or they are very upset about the trade deficit. It's a subset of the Republicans, but there's a block that actually – and then you add to that members of Congress who are from heavily agriculture districts or states. Because what almost certainly the administration would do, I mean, what any president would do, is before they go to Congress for a vote on a new NAFTA, they'll give notice to terminate the old NAFTA. They're going to make the vote a vote between between the new and nothing. They're not going to have a vote between old NAFTA and new NAFTA. They're going to make it so that if you're in an agriculture state, if you don't vote for the new NAFTA, and you might be a Republican who loves ISDS for your oops.
Go for it.
You may let me pick that back up. You may be a Republican in an ag district who hates labor standards, who loves corporate privileges for your donors, but in the end, you can't let the tariffs go back up and hit your farmers. So you could see votes that are, 300 votes in the House. You could see 65 votes in the Senate to pass a deal like that, with the Democrats voting for the major transformation of the agreement's terms and the Republicans voting not to have agricultural tariffs come back up. But here's the big if, Allison. Here's the big if. There's even as important as getting rid of ISDS is, vital. As important as the sunset clause is, critical. As big of a deal as the higher rule of origin and the wage standard would be, huge. If there are not strong and enforceable environmental and labor standards in the core of this agreement with swift and certain enforcement, we're still going to see companies who will outsource their jobs and their pollution to Mexico, pay poverty wages, dump toxins, and send the products back here. We need to set standards about what conduct is permissible and have rules that are enforceable. When it comes to labor, the unions have been working. Actually, this administration, unlike, sadly, bizarrely, counterintuitively, the Obama administration, this administration has had an open-door policy with the unions, and they've been working with them to try and come up with something that the unions think is good enough to support. It is not like the previous administration where basically with TPP, unions, public citizen, we were all told, sorry, you just must be idiots. If you're against the TPP, we don't care. Bye, we're doing it. In this case, they're actually working with them to try and we don't know if they'll get there. We don't know, but they're certainly trying very hard. When it comes to the environment, the environmental movement has decided not to engage with the administration, just from the perspective that this administration is so anti the environment, terrible in climate policy. So the environmental advocacy groups aren't engaging in trying to get a similar fix on the environment chapter that the labor folks are making. The labor folks have made a lot of progress on the standards. There's still a lot of work to be made on the enforcement. But the good news is on the environment chapter, there's a team of Democratic members of Congress who have been able to really engage on the environment chapter. And so they say it started out better than the TPP, which is, again, just counterintuitive, but the guys have seen the text. And now they're working to try and strengthen it. And they're trying to make sure any structural improvements that get made in the labor chapter get made in the environmental chapter, as far as, you know, the standard of review, the standard of violation, the enforcement. So we have to watch, have to see. And there's some other things we got to watch carefully for, because there are other things in the agreement that the corporate lobby wants, you know, bad stuff that we're all against. So we have to make sure it doesn't happen. Now, we know for some of that, we know already Mexico and Canada have said no to some of the most outrageous stuff that, you know, the U.S. corporate guys want, having to do with food safety and food labeling, having to do with the access to affordable medicines. You know, the other countries have just said, nope, 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 not going to go there. So those are places where the U.S. position is against consumer, environmental, and other concerns directly and absolutely, and the other countries are pushing back. But we are going to have to take a really close look at those other issues, because obviously, even if you had everything else right, you had some outrageous, you know, horrible thing on food safety, that's a problem. So Democrats in Congress have really been on top of that to try and make clear to the administration, hey, you're going to need our votes to pass the deal that gets rid of ISDS as a sunset clause, that actually raises standards that's against outsourcing. So don't put stuff in there we can't live with. And that's you know, it's that sensibility that has unions and public citizen and Democrats in Congress all engaging, because if there's going to be a deal they're trying to get passed with a lot of votes, that means it has to be something that doesn't have the really bad stuff in it, and the stuff we've been demanding forever has to be added. And so that's what we're fighting for, and there's some chance.
That's amazing. You know, this is surreal, almost, given where we are, but the appointment of this figure who is kind of in the perfect negotiating position to bring the best elements together, yeah, that would just be an incredible improvement. So I'm, you know, stunned and delighted to hear this. Well, we're coming to the end of the show. We have about another 4 minutes or so, or rather the end of the segment, because we'll be continuing with the show, and I hope, listeners, you will stay with us for the second half of Connect the Dots. So, you know, final thoughts, Lori Wallach of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Listeners, you can support that organization for its outstanding work by going to, you know, just Googling Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, and it'll take you to citizen.org, and you can contribute and follow this incredible path toward negotiation. What is it, or in what time frame can people kind of interact with this and support what's happening, or track it? What would you recommend, Lori?
Well, first of all, I would recommend that you go to www.replacenafta.org, www.replacenafta.org. You can sign up there to the action list, and you'll get updates. You'll get notice when things are happening in your neck of the woods across the country to get engaged. So, you know, for instance, the Canadian Prime Minister was in New York just now, and a bunch of New York activist colleagues were there, you know, basically making sure he knew we were watching these negotiations and what our demands were. The timeline for this is the talks are going to continue despite the Republicans trying to derail it. The talks are continuing. It's not a matter of getting a fast agreement, it's a matter of getting the right agreement. And so my gut instinct is we'll probably see talks wrap up over the next number of months. Likely a vote could not happen until next year. There's still a chance it could happen this year. You'll find all of that latest info if you sign up for at www.replacenafta.org. However, to put in context why this is so important, why so many of us who have been in this fight for fair trade for decades are throwing our all into this. This could be the chance, as peculiar and improbable as it seems, to replace that failed, damaging model that started with NAFTA, that got worse and worse until the TPP, that we finally built the power to stop in Congress. They could never get a majority of votes to pass TPP. All the 9 months, the agreement was sitting there, despite all the lobbying, the corporations, the president pushing it. So we're at this pivot point, and here it's almost like the unicorn, the mythical fair trade unicorn. We've been waiting for a new model for U.S. trade agreements for decades. It's emerging from the woods. And we want to basically have that unicorn put safely into a place where it can grow and be the new model. We do not want to have more of the same. We certainly don't want a TPP 2.0, which is what the corporate lobby has been trying to get and so far has failed to force their way. They're nuts, apoplectic about it, but they haven't gotten what they wanted. And so here maybe we have that unicorn moment to actually get what we'd want. And this is why that's so important. It will change people's lives in North America for sure. Imagine being able to help raise wages in Mexico, where wages are down since NAFTA and like the level of coastal China right now. Imagine the end of ISDS cases. But also, Allison, it would set a model going forward, replacing the old model. And for the rest of the world, the signal that here in the belly of the beast, we're saying no to ISDS, yes to a wage standard, yes to environmental and labor standards. As weird as it would be coming out of this despicable administration, having that policy on the books for people on the planet for the future would be an amazing, amazing win.
Okay, let me just say thank you so much for being with us today, Lori Wallach of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch and ReplaceNAFTA.org. Please stay tuned, listeners, for the second segment of today's Connect the Dots. We've been speaking with Lori Wallach of Global Trade Watch, and now we'll be talking with our second guest. And so, you know, pleased to discuss this rather intense topic, but something that we all need to think about on the second half of today's Connect the Dots. My guest now is Serge Plochy. He's the author of a book, Chernobyl, The History of a Nuclear Catastrophe. He is a professor of Ukrainian history and the director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. So Professor Plochy is both someone who is present in Russia at the time of Chernobyl, as well as an award-winning author of numerous books, and a Harvard professor and research director to this day. So we'll be talking with him today about his history of Chernobyl, what happened, and what some of the cautionary things that we need to learn from that experience are today. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Professor Plochy.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on your program, Allison.
So you were actually near to Chernobyl, in the vicinity, when the nuclear event happened. I'm assuming that most of our listeners are familiar with the Chernobyl event, which took place on April 26, 1986. But in case some of our younger readers are not, or listeners rather, are not aware, could you tell us about the event? Just describe it for people who are familiar.
Absolutely. Chernobyl nuclear power plant is located in northern Ukraine, and at the time of the explosion, I lived in Ukraine, approximately 500 kilometers down the stream on the Dnieper River. And one of the concerns was, of course, that the explosion would poison not only the area around the plant, but also that it would get to the water table, the so-called China syndrome, and would also poison the water supply. And I mentioned Dnieper, 30 million people in Ukraine depended on that water from Dnieper for their livelihood. So that was quite a scary situation, not just in the immediate environments of the reactor that exploded, but in a larger area. So to give our listeners some idea of what happened, 50 million curies of radiation were released by the Chernobyl explosion. And again, to help to understand what that means, it's approximately the radiation that would be released by 500 Hiroshima bombs. So it was quite dramatic. And what happened, it was a turbine test at the reactor that went terribly wrong. for numerous reasons that I discuss in my book. And to cause that kind of damage, it was enough for 5% of the nuclear fuel to escape from the reactor. So 95 stayed where it was, but one can imagine what would happen if more than 5% would be released into atmosphere.
That's quite a lot. Is Chernobyl today regarded as, you know, the biggest reactor explosion of, you know, the nuclear age?
Indeed. It's actually number one in terms of its severity, in terms of the damage that it caused. Second would be Fukushima disaster in Japan, and the third one would be the Three Mile Island meltdown, or not meltdown, but certainly the nuclear accident here in the United States. And chronologically, the Three Mile Island accident was the first. It was late 1970s, but again, after that, there were two additional ones, Chernobyl and Fukushima, and they in terms of their scope, in terms of the radiation that was released, the damage that was caused, almost dwarfed the Three Mile Island accident.
Mm-hmm. What, just to give our listeners just a kind of sense of what kind of damage are we actually talking about if there's a major nuclear reactor event of this type?
Well, the most scary thing is, of course, that it's the release of radiation that you can't see, and it's difficult to assess immediately what that means. So the direct, when the explosion took place, only two people were killed. Later, over the period of the next few weeks, there would be approximately, again, 29, but a little bit more later, people died as a direct exposure to radiation. So those would be firefighters, operators. And then we are talking about really thousands and tens of thousands of people whose health was affected. For example, we know that among the most affected category were children. And there would be a spike in the thyroid cancer among the children. The estimates are basically around 4,000 cases, additional cases of thyroid cancer that wouldn't be there if there would be no explosion. And then people affected in other ways, the estimate between 6,000 to 90,000, depending on what methods are used. We also know that in the people who are affected the most, it's not just they that suffer, but people born from them, their changes in DNA. So again, there are different ways to look at the damage that was caused by the reactor. Also, if you go now to the place where the Chernobyl nuclear power plant used to operate, now it's 30 kilometer exclusion zone, and you can see there a ghost city. So people abandon those areas.
I see. Mm-hmm. 30 kilometers is, how much is that in miles?
Well, in miles, that would be approximately, approximately 20 miles. I'll give you just in a sec. There are actually two zones. So, yeah, 30 kilometers would be 18.6 miles. And then within that zone, there is another actually zone, which is 10 kilometers or 6.2 miles. That's where the actual reactor is. And there are, these zones have different regimes in terms of who is allowed there and who is not.
So are those, so basically people had to be, either chose to abandon or had to be moved from and, you know, told to leave those zones? And do they remain now as we're speaking? You know, my God, it's 30 some odd, almost, you know, 40 years ago. Are those zones still radioactive and dangerous to cross?
Again, some of people, older people mostly, returned to the zone and keep living there. We are talking about maybe a couple dozen people. Altogether,
wow.
90,000 people were actually evacuated from the zone. The biggest settlement was the city of Pripyat. That's where the builders of the nuclear power plant and the operators lived.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the how long it will be contaminated, well, the plutonium-239, the element that is used in the building of the nuclear bombs, the half life of it is 24,000 years. And it's just half. So that means that the traces of plutonium-239 will be still probably close to 50,000 years from now, people or scholars, and if the world continues, they will be able to detect that something terrible happened there. That being said, not all of the areas within the zone itself were affected to the same degree. So today you can go on a tour, and actually I did that, to the damaged reactor. There is a new sarcophagus. The new shelter is being built. It should be completed before the end of the year. But other areas are still very, very heavily contaminated.
Know at the time? What was the, you know, what did you, being nearby, believe was happening, believe the risks were, and what was the Soviet government communicating about to the people?
Well, this is an excellent question. The Soviet government was, of course, as authoritarian government as it gets. And one of the things that they did, they were afraid of panic, so they were super secretive. An accident to the same degree happened in the Soviet Union in 1957, and that was kept under wraps, so no information was released to the West. Now, with Chernobyl, what happened, it was not the Soviet government, but it was the government in Sweden that first started to talk about this rise in radiation levels. So only after that, the Soviets were forced to release the first information, and they kept it basically secret from its own people. I and my family learned about the accident or what has to be done from the broadcast of Voice of America and BBC and Deutsche Welle. So the Western broadcasters served as and provided us with advice on what to do while our own government was silent. It took Mr. Gorbachev 18 days to address the nation and talk about what happened, and it took him 3 years to visit the site of the accident. So, and we are talking about the probably the most democratically inclined Soviet leader of all times.
Yes, that's right. Wow, that's really incredible. It must have been an absolutely uncertain and frightening experience for you, your family, and other people that you knew in the area.
It was, and we relied, as I said, on the information provided by Western broadcasters and on rumors. And I remember receiving an information that the water, allegedly contaminated water, was going down the Dnieper, and in 2 days it would reach the city. And of course, all water supply, bottled water, was immediately bought up and disappeared from the shelves of the stores. And it was terrifying. I was looking at the city, thinking, okay, in two days, the city would be dead. Fortunately, again, the level of contamination was not as big, and then it settled on the bottom of the river. Those were terrifying days and moments. And my children at that time, they were really, really young, 2 and 3 years old. So they spent the entire summer inside of the home. We wouldn't let them go and play outside out of concern of what could happen. And again, the main thing is lack of the information, and the authorities themselves, they were not sure what to expect, what that meant. Till today, we know. Again, it's difficult to assess the impact of Chernobyl radiation on the health, because what we know is based on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that's the immediate release of a significant amount of information over a short period of time. In Chernobyl, of course, what we have, it's a different story. It's a relatively low dosage of information, which is released over a longer period of time. And so the jury is still out there, the academic, the scientific jury, trying to figure out what happens in the first generation, what happens in the second generation, what happens to the animal world, to vegetation. Now you go to Chernobyl area, you go to the city of Pripyat, this abandoned city. It's kind of a nuclear age Pompeii, and you see that the vegetation took over the entire city, where it used to be the stadium, for example, the soccer field or something like that. Now you have a grove, and animals came back and took over the place, the city built by people, so people had to leave. The trees and grass and animals took over.
Mm-hmm. And you, of course, eventually emigrated with your family to this country?
Yes, I was. It was in 91, 92 that we moved to Canada. I was invited as a visiting professor, and it's 10 years that I'm here at Harvard. And again, that gives me certainly a new perspective on things. I was trying to use in my research not only local Ukrainian and Soviet archives, but also tried to look at what the reception of those things were here from the United States. Again, Chernobyl took place still at the time when the Cold War tensions were quite high. And it's interesting, I write about that in my book, that in Gorbachev's first address to the nation on the issue of Chernobyl, one-third of his speech was dedicated to the attacks on Reagan and the United States for allegedly using this accident to discredit the Soviet Union. So again, the Cold War would end within 2 or 3 years after the Chernobyl, but Chernobyl itself took place in the middle of really, really high tensions between the two countries.
Mm-hmm. What for you would be the important lessons learned, you know, from the mistakes that resulted in Chernobyl happening, in how people were warned in time, and in the science, you know, that is tracking this? Do you have any things that, you know, you would like to see or advise based upon your, you know, your book and your research into the whole situation?
Right. Well, first of all, Chernobyl, it's easier to blame Chernobyl on the problems with a particular type of reactors that the Soviets had, or on the inefficiency of the communist system that was in the state of decline. And all of those factors, they played their role. But there are also other things that are still with us till today. And I write in the book that, unfortunately, I think that other Chernobyl-type accidents can happen in the future. And this is related, first of all, to the question that if the nuclear energy technologies fall in the, not just nuclear weapons, but nuclear energy technologies, are in the hands of an authoritarian regime, like it was the case in the Soviet Union, the regimes that cut corners when it comes to safety, that put the geopolitical ambitions or economic development ahead of safety, we will unfortunately have the situations like that in the future. And in the last 10 years, for sure, there are very, very worrisome tendencies that are happening in the nuclear energy in the world as a whole. The center of the nuclear reactor construction has moved from North America and Western Europe to Russia, to China. Egypt is building two reactors. The United Arab Emirates are building reactors. So the Middle East, the most volatile part in the world, that's where they're building now reactors. And again, that's very dangerous because of authoritarian nature of the regime, the control that they can basically exercise over the engineers, over scientists, lack of experience and lack of the safety culture, nuclear safety culture. So all of that is extremely worrisome.
Yes, that all is very worrisome. And, you know, I think one could say that there are increasing tensions, a prizing of economic factors over safety and health factors, you know, by many governments in this world, our whole current situation. So all of that, that kind of corner cutting, changing of the rules, saying, we've got this, or, that's not so important to spend more dollars to assure, that proper testing measures or safety measures are implemented. I have covered, the lack of safety in nuclear reactors in the United States, which, that exists, and that's regarded as being, an environment that would be the most, careful in this regard than, a developing country with a long, with a history of authoritarian governments. But nevertheless, I mean, there's corners cut in this country. I mean, wherever the profit, orientation is like number one and far and above everything else, these kinds of dangers can happen,
Yes, I agree. And again, if there are lessons to be learned from Chernobyl, not just for the quote-unquote developing world, but also for this country, what I was really surprised to find in my documents, including recently declassified KGB documents, is how unprepared leadership, society as a whole was to what happened at Chernobyl. There was no awareness of what the symptoms of how radiation worked. The firefighters who fought the radioactive fire were not trained to do that. The population was not informed, but when informed, didn't know how to react. And I think about myself, and if something like that happens, I don't know what to do, except from what I learned from my archival research. And nuclear energy is still a very dangerous source of our prosperity in this country, and in other places it's 20% of our overall balance of energy, but it is there with new now ways of hacking and terrorism and things like that. I think that we should, as a society, more aware of the, not be scared, not panic, but aware at least of what should be done, what can be done in the situations like that.
I actually at one point was reporting on a nuclear power plant north of New York City, the Indian Point plant, which has a number of safety hazards, both inherent to the plant and, you know, in terms of a pipeline with a risk of explosion built through the actual plant center, you know, through the actual industrial center where the plant is. And so, you know, I've wrote about that and often wondered about the safety, and happened to one time, you know, meet with some, you know, on a completely other occasion, met up with some healthcare professionals who were part of, you know, the preparedness team. And when they discussed, you know, what is considered preparedness, it was almost laughable. I don't know what to say. It was like, it was just a little bit better than when we were told as kids to hide under the desk. You know, coming, unfortunately, to the end of our time here. It's been terrific talking with you. We've been speaking with Serhii Plokhii, the author of Chernobyl, The History of Nuclear Catastrophe. It's a book available from Basic Books. You can really immerse yourself in the reality of, you know, what can happen in a nuclear incident by reading this important book. Thank you so much for being with us today, Professor Plokhii.
Thank you. It was my pleasure and honor.
Yeah, thank you, and for your great work in pulling all of this together and your journey with this important questions. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. And looking ahead, everyone, in the challenging and difficult times we live in, I think this particular program has highlighted a few of them, to a very serious degree. But remember to keep heads up, hearts open, marching forward with all our relations to a better future for ourselves and future generations. Thank you for being with us. Till next time, I'm Allison Rose Levy.
Yeah, go.